to move. It had jammed in the snow bollard that he had dug around the snowstake above. Simon swore and set off towards the point where the wall was smallest, right on the crest of the ridge. I knew it was all unstable powder, and so did he, but he had no choice. I looked away, unwilling to watch what I was sure would be a fatal fall down the west face. Indirectly it would kill me as well, only a little more slowly. Simon had said nothing about what he would do, and I had been nervous to prompt him. In an instant, an uncrossable gap had come between us, and we were no longer a team working together.
Joe had disappeared behind a rise in the ridge, and began moving faster than I could go. I was glad we had put the steep section behind us at last. I had felt so close to the end of everything on that ridge, falling all the time and always on the very edge of the west face. I felt tired, and was grateful to be able to follow Joe's tracks instead of breaking trail. I rested a while when I saw that Joe had stopped moving. Obviously, he had found an obstacle, and I thought I would wait until he started moving again. When the rope moved again, I trudged forward after it, slowly. Suddenly, there was a sharp tug as the rope lashed out taut across the slope. I was pulled forward several feet as I pushed my axes into the snow and braced myself for another jerk. Nothing happened. I knew that Joe had fallen, but I couldn't see him, so I stayed put. I waited for about 10 minutes until the tautened rope went slack on the snow, and I felt sure that Joe had got his weight off me. I began to move along his footsteps cautiously, half expecting something else to happen. I kept tensed up and ready to dig my axes in at the first sign of trouble. As I crested the rise, I could see down a slope to where the rope disappeared over the edge of a drop. I approached slowly, wondering what had happened. When I reached the top of the drop, I saw Joe below me. He had one foot dug in and was leaning against the slope, with his face buried in the snow. I asked him what had happened, and he looked at me in surprise. I knew he was injured, but the significance didn't hit me at first. He told me very calmly that he had broken his leg. He looked pathetic, and my immediate thought came without any emotion. You're fucked, matey. You're dead. No two ways about it. I think he knew it too. I could see it in his face. It was all totally rational. I knew where we were. I took in everything around me instantly, and knew he was dead. It never occurred to me that I might also die. I accepted without question that I could get off the mountain alone. I had no doubt about that. I saw what Joe had tried to do and realized that unless I could arrange an abseil, I would have to do the same. The snow at the top of the cliff was horrendous, sugary stuff. I dug as much of the surface away as I could and then buried a snowstake in the mush I had uncovered. I felt sure it would never hold my weight, so I started digging a wide snow bollard around the stake. When I finished, I backed towards the cliff edge and tugged the rope. It held firm, but I had no confidence in it. I thought of trying to back-climb the crest of the ridge where the cliff was smallest, but decided it would be even more dangerous. I half-abseiled and half-climbed down the cliff, trying to get my weight off the rope. I felt it cutting through the bollard. It held firm. When I reached the foot of the cliff, I saw that Joe's leg was in a bad way, and that he was suffering. He seemed calm, but had a sort of hunted, fearful look in his eyes. He knew the score as well as I did. I gave him some pills for the pain, but knew they were not strong enough to help much. His leg was twisted and misshapen at the knee joint, and I thought that if I could see that through his thick polar fiber trousers, then it must be really bad. I was at a loss for something to say. The change in our fortunes was too abrupt. I found that the ropes had jammed and knew I would have to go back up, alone, to free them. In a way, it took my mind off things and gave me time to settle into the new situation. I had to solo back up the cliff, and the only way was right on the crest of the ridge. I was frightened of attempting it. Joe tried moving beside me and very nearly fell off. I grabbed him and put him back into balance. He stayed silent. He had unroped, so I had been able to arrange the abseil, and I think he was quiet, because he knew that if I hadn't grabbed him, he would have fallen the length of the east face. I left him then, and forgot about him. The climb up the edge of the cliff was the hardest and most dangerous thing I'd ever done. Several times, my leg broke through the powder into space. When I was halfway up, I realized I couldn't go back, but I didn't think I would get up it. I seemed to be climbing on nothing. Everything I touched simply broke away. Every step either sank back, collapsed, or crumbled down the west face. But incredibly, I seemed to be gaining height. I don't know how long it took. It felt like hours. When eventually I pulled myself onto the slope above, I was shaking and so strung out that I had to stop still and calm myself. I looked back and was amazed to see that Joe had started traversing away from the cliff. He was trying to help himself by contouring round the small rise in front of him. He moved so slowly, planting his axes in deeply until his arms were buried, and then making a frightening little hop sideways. He shuffled across the slope, head down, completely enclosed in his own private struggle. Below him, I could see thousands of feet of open face falling into the eastern glacier bay. I watched him quite dispassionately. I couldn't help him, and it occurred to me that in all likelihood he would fall to his death. I wasn't disturbed by the thought. In a way, I hoped he would fall. I knew I couldn't leave him while he was still fighting for it, but I had no idea how I might help him. I could get down. If I tried to get him down, I might die with him. It didn't frighten me. It just seemed a waste. It would be pointless. I kept staring at him, expecting him to fall. After a long wait, I turned and went up to the snow stake. I rearranged the stake and then back down to the cliff edge again. I prayed it would hold me. And when I touched down on the slope below, prayed again that it wouldn't jam. I had no intention of repeating the climb up the crest. The rope slid down easily, and I turned with it, half expecting to see that Joe had gone. He was still climbing away from me. In all the time it had taken me to get up and down, he had covered only 100 feet. I started after him.
Simon suddenly appeared at my side. I had been unable to watch him climbing the crest. I felt sure he would fall. Instead, I thought I had better try to get moving. I knew I would never get over the rise, so I began to contour it. I didn't think of the consequences. I'd seen Simon struggling on the powder. Progress was slow and tiring, but I was so focused in on moving carefully that I could ignore much of the pain. It became one more difficulty to contend with and merged with all the other problems, balance, the snow conditions, and one-leggedness. A pattern of movements developed after my initial wobbly hops, and I meticulously repeated the pattern. Each pattern made up one step across the slope, and I began to feel detached from everything around me. I thought of nothing but the patterns. Only once did I stop and glance back at Simon. He seemed to be on the very point of falling, and I looked away quickly. I could see the endless fall of the east face beneath my feet. It was tempting to think I could survive falling down it, yet I knew that despite there being evenly angled snow all the way, the speed of the fall would rip me to shreds long before I reached the bottom. I thought of falling down it anyway, but it meant nothing to me. I felt no fright at the idea. It seemed such an obvious and unavoidable fact. It was academic, really. I knew I was done for. It would make no difference in the long run. Simon climbed past me and began stamping a trench across the slope until he had gone out of sight round the curve of the slope. He said he was going ahead to see what lay round the corner. Neither of us discussed what we were going to do. I don't think we thought there was anything. So I got back into my patterns. The trench made it easier, but it still needed total attention. It struck me that we were both avoiding the issue. For over 2 hours we had acted as if nothing had happened. We had a silent agreement. It needed time to work itself out. We both knew the truth. It was very simple. I was injured and unlikely to survive. Simon could get down alone. While I waited on his actions, it felt as if I was holding something terrifyingly fragile and precious. If I asked Simon to help, I might lose this precious thing. He might leave me. I remained silent, but it was no longer for fear of losing control. I felt coldly rational. The patterns merged into automatic rhythm. I was surprised to hear Simon ask if I was all right. I'd forgotten about him, and had no idea how long I'd been repeating the patterns. I had almost forgotten why I was doing them. I looked up and saw Simon sitting in the snow watching me. I smiled at him, and he returned a lopsided sort of grin which failed to mask his anxiety. He sat overlooking the slope, running down the side of the rise round which he had contoured. Behind him I could see the crest of the ridge. "I can see the col," he said, and I felt a surge of hope run through me like a cold wind. "Is it clear? I mean, is it a straight slope down?" I asked, trying to keep the edge of excitement from my voice. "More or less." I hurried my patterned moves, and at the same time tried not to rush. Suddenly I was scared of the drop below. I could feel myself trembling and realized that if I had felt like this when I had set out, I would never have got to this point. When I reached him, I slumped against the snow. Simon put his hand on my shoulder. "How are you doing?" "It's better. Painful, but..." I felt small and useless, telling him. His concern scared me, and I was unsure what was behind it. Perhaps he wanted to break the news to me softly. "I've had it, Simon. I can't see myself getting down at this rate." If I expected an answer, I didn't get one. It felt melodramatic to have voiced it, and he ignored the implied question. He began untying the ropes from his harness. I looked down to the col. It was about 600 feet below us and slightly to the right. Without thinking, I began to work out possible ways of getting to it. To descend directly to the col would be very difficult, since it meant a diagonal descent, crossing the angle of the slope. It would have to be straight down and then horizontally across to the col. The traverse appeared shorter than the slope I'd just crossed. "Do you think you can hold my weight in this snow?" I asked. We had no snow stakes left. If Simon took my weight on the rope, he would have to do so standing on the loose open slope with no anchors. "If we dig a big bucket seat, I should be able to hold you. If it starts to collapse, I can always shout and you can take your weight off." "Okay, it'd be quicker if you lowered me on two ropes tied together." He nodded in agreement. Already he had begun to dig out his belay seat. I grabbed the two ropes, knotted them together, and tied myself into the free end. The other end was already attached to Simon's harness. In effect, we were now roped together with 1 300-foot line, which would halve the time spent digging belay seats and double the distance lowered. Simon could control the speed of my descent by using a belay plate, and so reduce any sudden jerks of weight and avoid having the rope run away from him if he couldn't get a grip on it with his frozen mitts. The one problem was the knot joining the two ropes. The only way to get it past the belay plate would be by disconnecting the rope from the plate and then reconnecting it with the knot on the other side. This would be possible only if I stood up and took my weight off the rope. I thanked my stars that I hadn't broken both legs. "Okay, you ready?" Simon was seated in the deep hole he had dug in the slope, with his legs braced hard into the snow. He held the belay plate locked off with the rope to me taut between us. "Yes. Now take it steady. If anything slips, yell." "Don't worry, I will. If you can't hear me when the knot comes up, I'll tug the rope 3 times. "Right." I lay on my chest immediately beneath Simon, and edged down until all my weight was on the rope. Initially, I couldn't commit myself to letting my feet hang free of the snow. If the seat crumbled straight away, we would be falling instantaneously. Simon nodded at me and grinned. Encouraged by his confidence, I lifted my feet and began to slide down. It worked. He let the rope out smoothly in a steady descent. I lay against the snow, holding an axe in each hand, ready to dig them in the moment I felt a fall begin. Occasionally, the crampons on my right boot snagged in the snow and jarred my leg. I tried not to cry out, but failed. I didn't want Simon to stop. In a surprisingly short time, he did stop. I looked up and saw that he had receded far from me, and I could make out only his head and shoulders leaning out from the seat in the snow. He shouted something, but I couldn't make it out until 3 sharp tugs explained it. After the endless time traversing the rise, I was astounded at the speed at which I had descended 150 feet. Astounded and pleased as punch, I wanted to giggle. In so short a time my mood had swung from despair to wild optimism, and death rushed back to being a vague possibility rather than the inevitable fact. The rope went slack as I hopped up onto my good leg. I was acutely aware that while Simon was changing the knot over, we were at our most vulnerable. If I fell, I would drop a whole rope's length before it came tight on him, and he would be whipped off the mountain by the impact. I dug my axes in and stayed motionless. I could see the col below and to my right, already a lot closer. More tugs on the rope, and I carefully leant my body down the slope as the second half of the lower began. I waved up at the distant red and blue dot above me and saw him stand up out of the seat. He turned and faced into the slope and began kicking his feet into the snow. The rope curled down past me. Simon was on his way down. I turned and started to excavate another seat. I dug deep into the slope, making a hole that he could sit completely inside. I curved the back wall and the floor so that it rose up to the lip of the hole. When satisfied, I looked back up to see Simon back climbing quickly towards me. The next lowering was much quicker. We had adopted an efficient system. One shadow lay over our building optimism: the weather. It had deteriorated rapidly, clouds flitting across the Col and a great mass of cloud boiling up in the east. The wind was increasing steadily, blowing powder snow across the slope. I could see plumes of snow streaming horizontally out over the west face. As the wind grew, so the temperature dropped. I could feel it burning into my face, numbing my chin and nose. My fingers began to freeze. Simon joined me at the end of the second lowering. We were almost level with the Col, but there was a horizontal traverse to be made to get to its edge. "I'll go ahead and make a trench." He didn't wait for an answer, and I felt exposed as I watched him move away from me. It looked a long way to the Col. I wondered whether to unrope. I didn't want to, even though logic told me the rope wouldn't save me now. If I fell, I would take Simon with me, but I couldn't bring myself to dispense with the comforting reassurance of the rope. I glanced at Simon. I couldn't believe it. He'd reached the Col, yet he was only about 80 feet from me. The late afternoon light had disguised the distance. "Come on," he shouted above the wind. "I've got the rope." There was a gentle tug at my waist. He had taken in the remaining slack and intended belaying me. I thought that he meant to jump down the west side if I fell. There was no other way of stopping me. I hobbled sideways and nearly lost balance as I snagged my foot. Something gristly twisted in my knee, and the shock had me sobbing. It eased away, and I swore at myself for not concentrating. The crabbed sideways pattern of movements which I had tried before took over once more. When I couldn't swing my leg across, I reached down and hefted it along the trench Simon had forged, and then returned to my patterns. The leg had become inanimate, a weighty, useless object. If it got in my way or pained me, I cursed it and hefted it aside as if it were a chair I'd tripped over. The Col was exposed and windy, but for the first time we could see clearly down the west flank of the mountain. Directly beneath us, the glacier we had walked up 5 days ago curved away towards the moraines and crevasses which led to base camp nearly 3,000 feet below us. It would take many long lowerings, but it was all downhill, and we had lost the sense of hopelessness that had invaded us at the ice cliff. Reaching the Col had been crucial. If there had been any steep ground between the cliff and the Col, we would never have got past it. "What time is it?" Simon asked. "Just gone 4. We don't have much time, do we?" I could see him weighing up the possibilities. The face below the Col was running with spindrift, and the cloud build-up was nearly complete. It was hard to judge whether it had started snowing because of the powder being swept against us by the wind. We hadn't sat on the Col for very long, yet already I was numb with cold. I wanted to carry on down, but it was Simon's decision. I waited for him to make up his mind. "I think we should keep going," he said at last. "Will you be all right?" "Yes, let's go. I'm freezing." "Me too. My hands have gone again." "We could snowhole if you like." "No, we won't reach the glacier in the light, but it's a clear slope down. Better to lose height." "Right. I don't like the look of this weather. That's what worries me." "Okay, I'll lower you from here. We should go down further to the right, but I don't think you'll be able to make it diagonally. We'll just have to take our chances straight down." I slid off the crest of the ridge and down the west face. Simon stood back from the edge, bracing himself against my weight. The first of many powder avalanches rushed over me, tugging me down. I slid faster and shouted to Simon to slow down, but he couldn't hear me. 6. The Final Choice. I dug the bucket seat with frantic and nervous haste. The first lowering 300 feet down from the Col had worried me. It had been quite impossible to descend in a diagonal line to the right. Gravity had turned me into a dead weight, and no amount of scrabbling against the snow with ice axes had prevented a plumb vertical descent. The conditions on the face were markedly different from those on the slopes above the Col. Simon let me slide faster than I had expected, and despite my cries of alarm and pain, he had kept the pace of descent going. I stopped shouting to him after 50 feet. The rising wind and continuous spindrift avalanches drowned out all communications. Instead, I concentrated on keeping my leg clear of the snow. It was an impossible task. Despite lying on my good leg, the crampons on the right boot snagged in the snow as the weight of my body pushed down, each abrupt jerk causing searing pain in my knee. I sobbed and gasped, swore at the snow and the cold, and most of all, at Simon. At the changeover point, I hopped onto my left leg after feeling the tugs on the rope, and hammering the axe shafts into the snow, bent over them, trying to think the pain away. It ebbed slowly, leaving a dreadful throbbing ache and a leaden tiredness. The tugs came again far too soon, and carelessly I slumped against the rope and let myself go. The drop went on until I could bear it no longer, yet there was nothing that I could do to bring the agony to an end. Howling and screaming for Simon to stop achieved nothing. The blame had to lie somewhere, so I swore Simon's character to the devil. I kept thinking the rope must come to an end, that I would stop at any moment, but it seemed to have doubled in length. The face here was much steeper than above the col, steep enough to frighten me, and make me think that Simon was barely in control. I couldn't ignore the thought of his seat collapsing and tensed up. I waited for the instant, swooping acceleration that would tell me Simon had been pulled down, and that we were dying. It didn't happen. The terrible sliding stopped, and I hung silently against the slope. Three faint tugs trembled the taut rope, and I hopped up onto my leg. A wave of nausea and pain swept over me. I was glad of the freezing blasts of snow biting into my face. My head cleared as I waited for the burning to subside from my knee. Several times I had felt it twist sideways when my boot snagged, and each time the movement was unnatural. There would be a flare of agony as the knee kinked back, and parts within the joint seemed to shear past each other with a sickening, gristly crunch. I had barely ceased sobbing before my boot snagged again. At the end, my leg shook uncontrollably. I tried to stop it shaking, but the harder I tried, the more it shook. I pressed my face into the snow, gritted my teeth, and waited. At last it eased. Simon had already started to climb down, and the slack rope coiled past me as he descended. I looked up but failed to make out where he was. A plume of snow boiled down, hugging the slope. I could see nothing through it. If anything, the spindrift was worse than before, and that could only mean that it had begun snowing heavily. Below me the view was equally limited. I began digging Simon's belay seat. It was warming work and distracted attention from my knee. When I looked up again, Simon could be seen descending quickly. "At this rate, we should be down by 9 o'clock," he said cheerfully. "I hope so." I said no more. It wouldn't help to harp on about how I felt. "Right, let's do it again." He had seated himself in the hole and had the ropes ready for another lowering. "You're not hanging around, are you? Nothing to wait for. Come on." He was still grinning, and his confidence was infectious. Who said one man can't rescue another, I thought. We had changed from climbing to rescue, and the partnership had worked just as effectively. We hadn't dwelt on the accident. There had been an element of uncertainty at first, but as soon as we had started to act positively, everything had come together. "Okay, ready when you are," I said, lying on my side again. "Slow down a bit this time. You'll have my leg off otherwise." He didn't seem to hear me, for I went down at an even faster pace than before, and the hammering torture began again with a vengeance. My optimism evaporated. I could think of nothing but enduring until the changeover. It came after an age, but the brief respite was too short, and before the agony had eased, I was sliding down again. I pressed my hands against the snow, vainly trying to lift my leg away from the surface. The axes dangled from their loops around my waist, and my hands froze. My legs snagged. There was nothing I could do. The muscles had seized up. I tried and tried again to lift it clear of the snow, but it had fused into lumpy dead weight. I clenched my thigh muscles in an attempt to lift it clear, but nothing happened. It was no longer a part of me. It obeyed no commands and dangled inert and useless. It snagged and snagged again, twisted, kinked, and caused every sort of agony until I gave up trying and lay limp against the moving snow, sobbing. The lowering continued. I forgot about it ending, and gave myself up to the pain. It swamped round my knee and ran up my thigh, infusing all my conscious thoughts with its heat. It pitched higher with every jolt, insisting on attention, becoming something endowed with its own individuality, until I could hear its message clearly. I'm hurt, I'm damaged, rest me, leave me be. The movement stopped abruptly. Three tugs tremored down. I stood up, shaking. I tried to grab the axe to begin digging the next bucket seat, but couldn't grip the shaft. When I had made it stay in my mitt, it flopped from side to side. I tried picking up the hammer, with the same result. I tugged at my right mitt, but couldn't hold it tight enough to get it off, and eventually ripped it free with my teeth. The blue thermal gloves stayed on my hand, ice frosted onto the fabric. Even through the gloves, I could see how wooden my fingers had become. They moved stiffly and altogether, and refused to curl into a fist. Spindrift poured down the surface of the slope, filling the mitt which hung from its loop on my wrist while I held my hand under my armpit inside my jacket. The searing pain of returning blood was all I could think about. Even the mushy agony in my lower leg waned before this frightful burning heat in my fingers. When it eased, I emptied my mitt, put the gloved hand back into it, and repeated the process with the other hand. Simon came down before I had half finished digging his belay seat. He waited silently, head bowed. When I looked at him, I saw that he had both hands in his armpits. "Mine were real bad. I thought they were frostbitten," I said. "It's just the lowering. They really freeze up when I'm lowering. Can't get my middle fingers to warm. They've gone altogether." He had his eyes tight closed, fighting the hot aches. A heavier burst of spindrift sprayed over him, but he ignored it. It partially filled the seat I had been digging. I swept it clear with the side of my arm. "Come on, it's getting bad. We'll have to hurry." I lay beneath his feet, and when the rope came taut, I shifted my weight off my foot and tensed against the prospect of another drop. He let me down with a rush, and I cried out as my boot caught in the snow. I was looking at him when I cried out. He remained expressionless and continued to lower me. He had no time for sympathy. By the end of the fourth drop, I had deteriorated. The shaking in my leg was continuous and unstoppable. The pain had reached a level beyond which it wouldn't go. It remained constant whether I snagged my leg or not. Curiously, it had become more bearable, for I no longer winced and tensed at the prospect of catching my foot. I could adjust to the steady pain. My hands, however, were much worse. The rewarming repeated at the end of every lowering was less effective each time. Simon's hands were even worse than mine. The storm had steadily increased until the spindrift flowed continually down the slope, and threatened to push me off when I dug the seats. The wind gusted across the face, blasting the snow into exposed skin, and forcing itself through the tiniest of openings in clothing. I was close to exhaustion. As the drops continued, I lapsed into resigned tolerance. The object of the lowering had long since escaped me. I couldn't think any further ahead than simply enduring the present. Simon said nothing at the changeovers, his expression fixed and rigid. We had locked ourselves into a grim struggle. My part was pain-racked. Simon's an endless physical battle to get me down almost 3,000 feet without a break. I wondered how often it had occurred to him that the seats might collapse at any moment. I was beyond caring about such things, but Simon knew all the time that he could descend alone quite safely if he chose. I began to thank him for what he was doing, and then quickly stopped myself. It would only emphasize my dependence on him. I dug the fifth belay seat while Simon climbed down to me. I didn't get far. After clearing the surface snow away, I struck water ice. I was standing on my left boot, but it wasn't kicked deeply in. I perched on the front points of my crampons, a worrying position because I could feel my calf muscles tiring from the strain, and the idea that I might slip preyed on my mind. It would rip us both off the mountain. To make matters worse, the effect of staying quite still made me feel nauseous and dizzy. I kept shaking my head and pressing it against the snow, terrified that I might faint. It seemed such a stupid way to die after we had been through so much. It was a measure of how cold I had become to see how long it took before I thought of hammering an ice screw into the slope. The wind and constant avalanches had fogged my mind after numbing my body. Even when the idea did occur to me, it took some time to break through the lethargic apathy that engulfed me, and turning it into action seemed an achievement in itself. I was alarmed at my behaviour. I had heard of people succumbing to cold without realizing it, reacting lazily and without thinking. When I had tied into the ice screw, I leant back on it and began a vigorous warming and waking exercise. I moved as much of my body as I could, flapped my arms, rubbed myself briskly, and shook my head. I warmed gradually and felt the sluggishness clear away. Simon noticed the ice screw. It was in the only ice we had so far found on the face, and he looked at me questioningly. "There must be something below us. A steep section, something like that," I said. "Yeah. I can't see a thing down there." He was leaning out from the screw, peering intently below him. "It does get steeper, but I can't see what's causing it." I looked down and saw only the swirling clouds of spindrift whipping down. The sky was full of snow. It was either falling or being blown by the wind. The end result was the same, whiteout conditions. "It wouldn't be a good idea to lower me if you don't know what's below," I said. "It could be anything, a rock buttress, icefall, anything. I know, but I can't remember seeing anything very large when we were on Surya Norte, can you?" "No. A few rock outcrops, maybe, but nothing else. Why don't you abseil down and give me some tugs if it's okay to follow? I reckon I can abseil myself." "We haven't any choice." "Right. I'll put another screw in." He hammered the screw into the hard water ice and clipped the doubled rope through it. I untied from the rope, staying safely clipped into my own ice screw. When Simon reached the end of the rope, he would organize a belay and then signal me to follow. I shouted to him when he had abseiled below me, "Keep a knot in the end of the ropes. If I faint, I don't want to go off the end." He waved acknowledgement and slid down into clouds of spindrift. He was soon lost from sight, and I was alone. I tried not to think of anything happening to him. I stood quietly on one foot, gazing into the snow swirling madly round me. There was only the sound of hissing as it sprayed off my jacket, and occasional tugs from the wind. It was a wild place in which to be alone. I thought of the sun on Yerapaha, through the window in the snow cave. That was this morning, God. It seemed so very long ago. Only this morning. And we had come down the ridge and over those crevasses, and then the ice cliff. A lifetime away. So much had changed. The cold crept through me again, and I could feel its heavy slowness spreading. I started my warming routine again, flapping, rubbing, driving the intruder away. Then I saw the ropes jerk spasmodically. I grabbed hold of them and felt the tugs come up the ropes again. I fixed my belay plate onto the ropes and removed the ice screw from which I had been hanging. I let my weight come down carefully onto the abseil ropes, watching the ice screw for any warning signs of failure. The ropes eased through the plate, and I slid down after Simon. After 20 feet, the slope dropped vertically under me. I stopped moving and glanced down. I could see the angle ease about 15 feet below. Beyond, there was only spindrift. As I abseiled past the wall, I could see that it consisted of patches of ice plastered onto a steep rock face. It went slowly past me in short, stepped walls with steep ice cascades in between. Once or twice I bumped painfully against the rock, but for the most part I found abseiling to be easier and a lot less traumatic than being lowered. I could control the speed of descent, which helped. The steep walls were entirely pain-free because I could twist away and let my injured leg hang free in space, and even on the cascades I managed to keep from snagging it. I was concentrating on abseiling carefully and had become quite engrossed in what I was doing when Simon's voice broke into my thoughts. I looked down and saw him leaning back on an ice screw, grinning at me. "There's one more steep bit. I saw the snow slope running below it, so it can't be far." As he spoke, he reached out and caught hold of my waist, tugging me gently towards him. He was careful, almost tender, in the way he spun me round, so that I was facing out from the slope when I came to a stop beside him. He clipped me into a second ice screw that he had placed beside the one on which he was hanging, and directed my uninjured leg to a foothold that he had hacked from the ice. I realized then that he had been fully aware of the pain he had been putting me through, and this concern was a quiet way of saying, "It's all right. I wasn't being a bastard. It just had to be done." "Not far now. Maybe another 4 lowers after this next abseil." I knew he was guessing. He was trying to cheer me up, and I felt deeply grateful. For a short moment on the storm-swept belay, we had accepted a warm sense of friendship. It felt like some cliché from a third-rate war movie. "We're all in this together, lads, and we're all going to make it home." It also felt true and real, something unassailable in all the uncertainty. I put my arm on his shoulder and smiled at him. Behind his grin, I could see the truth of our situation. It had taken a lot out of him, and he looked drawn. His face, pinched with cold, showed all the tension he had been through, and his eyes didn't smile. There was concern and anxiety there, and I could see that, despite his confident words, a dark uncertainty reflected the real story. "I'm all right," I said. "The pain's not so bad now. How are your hands?" "Bad, and getting worse." He grinned at me. and I felt a stab of guilt. It was costing him. I had already paid. I'll abseil down and set up the belay. He stepped away from the slope and hopped smoothly into the vortex of spindrift below. I quickly joined him at the large bucket seat he had excavated. We were back to lowering from non-existent belays. I checked my watch. I couldn't see the face, and was surprised to notice how dark it had become. When I flicked the little watch light on, I saw that it was 7:30. It had been dark for over an hour, and I hadn't noticed. It made me realize how little I had had to do. Digging belay seats and closing my mind to the lowering hadn't needed any light. The warmth of feeling on the abseil belay stayed with me through the next drop, and I had to resist the urge to giggle excitedly as the descent continued. I felt childishly irrational. The thought of reaching the glacier and a snug snow cave had become irresistible. It flooded through my mind like the images of a hot meal in front of the fire after a long cold day on the hills. I tried to push it away, fearful that to think this way would be to invite disaster. I want never gets, I told myself. But it didn't work. The lowering went quicker and easier. The pain stayed with me, but it was secondary. Getting down was all I could think about. The system of lowering became second nature, as if we had been practicing it for years, and as we slid down unseen through the storm, the sense of optimism snowballed with every foot descended. Simon's grin widened at every meeting, and his eyes, bright in the light from my head torch, said it all. We had regained control of the situation, and it no longer felt as if we were fleeing in disarray or fighting desperately against the odds. We knew we were making a controlled and orderly descent. I hunched my shoulders against an unusually heavy rush of spindrift and braced myself until it spent itself. Moving again, the build-up of snow between my chest and the slope flowed down over my legs, and I brushed the powder from the belay seat I had dug. The weather showed no sign of improving, but at least it was not getting worse. Simon appeared from the murk above me. His light flashed yellow off the clouds of snow. I kept looking at him so that my head torch light would guide him down. He reached me as another avalanche swept over us. We both ducked. Bloody hell! That one before nearly knocked me off. They've been getting bigger, probably because we're near the bottom. There's more snow to build up on the way down. I was thinking of unroping. Then I won't take you down if I get hit hard. I laughed. If he fell past me, leaving me the rope, I would be able to do nothing with it. I'd fall anyway, so you might as well stay roped. That way I won't have to think about it. And I can blame you. He didn't laugh. He had almost forgotten that I was hurt, and now I had reminded him. He settled himself into the seat and arranged the ropes for the next lowering. Two lowers to go at the most, I reckon. This will be the eighth, plus the two abseils, so we've covered 2,700 feet, or thereabouts. It can't be more than 3,000, so this might even be the last one. I nodded in agreement, and he grinned confidently at me as I slid down the slope, and he faded into the snowstorm. Earlier, I had noticed that the angle of the slope was gradually easing. I took this as an encouraging sign, which indicated how close we were getting to the glacier. However, soon after I lost sight of Simon, I noticed the slope steepening again. I slid faster and snagged my foot more frequently. I was distracted by the pain and discomfort and thought no more of the slope. I struggled vainly to clear my foot from the snow before giving up and accepting the torment. The sense of weight on my harness increased, as did the speed. I tried braking with my arms, but to no effect. I twisted round and looked up into the darkness. Rushes of snow flickered in my torch beam. I yelled for Simon to slow down. The speed increased and my heart jumped wildly. Had he lost control? I tried braking again. Nothing. I stifled the rising panic and tried to think clearly. No, he hadn't lost control. I'm going down fast, but it's steady. He's trying to be quick. That's all. I knew it to be true, but there was still something wrong. It was the slope. Of course. I should have thought of it earlier. It was now much steeper, and that could mean only one thing. I was approaching another drop. I screamed out a frantic warning, but he couldn't hear me. I shouted again as loud as I could, but the words were whipped away into the snow clouds. He wouldn't have heard me 15 feet away. I tried to guess how far I was from the halfway knot. 100 feet? 50? I had no idea. Each lowering became timeless. I slid forever through the boiling snow without any sense of time passing, just a barely endurable period of agony. A sense of great danger washed over me. I had to stop. I realized that Simon would hear nothing, so I must stop myself. If he felt my weight come off the rope, he would know there must be a good reason. I grabbed my ice axe and tried to break my descent. I leant heavily over the axe head, burying it in the slope, but it wouldn't bite. The snow was too loose. I dug my left boot into the slope, but it too just scraped through the snow. Then abruptly, my feet were in space. I had time to cry out and claw hopelessly at the snow before my whole body swung off an edge. I jerked onto the rope and toppled over backwards, spinning in circles from my harness. The rope ran up to a lip of ice, and I saw that I was still descending. The sight vanished as a heavy avalanche of powder poured over me. When it ceased, I realized that I'd stopped moving. Simon had managed to hold the impact of my body suddenly coming onto the rope. I was confused. I didn't understand what had happened, except that I was hanging free in space. I grabbed the rope and pulled myself up to a sitting position. The spinning continued, but it was slowing down. I could see an ice wall 6 feet away from me every time I completed a spin. When I stopped spinning, I was facing away from the wall and had to twist round to look at it. The spindrift had stopped. I shone my torch up the wall, following the line of the rope, until I could make out the edge I had gone over. It was about 15 feet above me. The wall was solid ice and steeply overhanging. The rope jerked down a few inches, then stopped. Another avalanche of powder poured over the edge, and the wind blew it in eddies round me. I hunched protectively. Looking between my legs, I could see the wall dropping below, angled away from me. It was overhanging all the way to the bottom. I stared down, trying to judge the height of the wall. I thought I could see the snow-covered base of the wall with the dark outline of a crevasse directly beneath me, then snow flurries blocked my view. I looked back at the edge above. There was no chance of Simon hauling me up. It would have been extremely hard with a solid belay. Sitting in the snow seat, it would be suicidal to attempt it. I shouted at the darkness above and heard an unintelligible muffled yell. I couldn't be sure whether it had been Simon or an echo of my own shout. I waited silently, hugging the rope with my arms to stay upright and feeling shocked as I stared between my legs at the drop. Gradually, and with a sense of mounting dread, I began to get some perspective into what I was looking at. I was an awfully long way above the crevasse at the base of the cliff, and as it slowly dawned on me, I felt my stomach lurch with fear. There was at least 100 feet of air below my feet. I kept staring at the drop, hoping to find I was mistaken. I realized that far from being wrong, I had been conservative in my estimate. For a moment I did nothing while my thoughts whirled and I tried to assess how things had changed. Then one fact jolted through my thoughts. I swung round and stared at the wall. It was 6 feet from me. At full arm's reach, I still couldn't reach the ice with my axe. I tried swinging towards the wall, but ended up spinning helplessly. I knew that I had to get back up the rope, and I had to do it quickly. Simon had no idea what I'd gone over. The other steep drops were short walls. He had no reason to assume this would be any different. In that case, he might lower me. Oh, Jesus, I'll jam on the halfway not long before I get to the bottom. It was impossible to reach the wall, and I realized quickly that it wouldn't help me. I couldn't climb 15 feet of overhanging ice with one leg. I fumbled at my waist for the 2 loops of rope I had tied there. I found them, but couldn't grip them with my mitts on. I wrenched off the mitts with my teeth and reached for the 2 loops again. I slipped one over my wrist and held the second in my teeth. In reaching for the loops, I had let go of the rope and tumbled over backwards so that I hung from the waist. My rucksack had pulled me over, and I hung in an inverted curve with my head and legs lower than my waist. I struggled to swing up until I reached the rope and pulled myself back to a sitting position. I crooked my left arm round the rope to hold me upright, and took the loop from my teeth with my right hand. I tried to twist the thin loop of cord round the rope, but my fingers were too numbed. I needed to get a prussic knot onto the rope so that I could slide the knot up and hang in tension as the knot tightened. The effort of holding myself up was exhausting. At last, using a combination of teeth and hand, I managed to twist the loop around the rope and then tried repeating the process. I needed at least 3 twists before the knot would be of any use. By the time I had succeeded, I was almost crying with frustration. It had taken me nearly 15 minutes. The wind nudged me into a gentle spin and blasted the incessant avalanches into my face, blinding me. I clipped a carabiner into the prussic loop and fastened it to my waist. I shoved the loop as far up the rope as I could reach and leant back on it. The knot tightened, slipped a few inches, and then held me. I let go of the rope and hung back. I remained sitting up. The second loop had to be tied onto the rope, but this time I would be able to use both hands. It wasn't until I tried to slip it off my left wrist that I realized how useless my hands were. Both were frozen. I could move the fingers of my right hand, but my left hand, which had been still as I held onto the rope, had seized. I thumped them together, bending the fingers in against my palms. I hit them, bent them, hit them again and again, but there were no hot aches. Some movement and feeling returned, but it was minimal. I took the loop from my wrist and held it against the rope. At my first attempt to twist it around and back inside itself, I dropped it. It fell onto the main rope knot on my harness, and I grabbed at it before it was blown off. Then, as I lifted it to the rope, it seemed to slide out of my hand. I grabbed at it with my left hand and managed to catch it against my right forearm. I couldn't pick it up. My fingers refused to close round it, and as I tried slipping it up my arm, it dropped again. This time I watched it fall away beneath me. I knew at once that I now had no chance of climbing up the rope. It would have been hard enough doing it with two loops, and now, with both hands so useless, I had no chance. I slumped onto the rope and swore bitterly. At least I wasn't having to hold myself up. It was a consolation, although I knew it achieved little else. The rope ran up from my waist, taut as an iron bar. The loop I had attached gripped the rope 3 feet above my harness. I unclipped it from my harness and then threaded it through my rucksack straps so that it pulled them together across my chest. I fastened it with my last carabiner and leant back to test it. The effect was good. The loop now held my torso up on the rope so that I sat in space as if in an armchair. When I was sure it was as good as I could get it, I slumped back onto the rope, feeling utterly weary. The wind gusted against me, making me swing crazily on the rope, and with each gust I was getting colder. The pressure of the harness on my waist and thighs had cut off the circulation, and both legs felt numb. The pain in the knee had gone. I let my arms hang slackly, feeling the dead weight of useless hands in my mitts. There was no point in reviving them. There was no way out of this slow hanging. I couldn't go up, and Simon would never get me down. I tried to work out how long it had been since I had gone over the edge. I decided it could be no more than half an hour. In 2 hours I would be dead. I could feel the cold taking me. Twinges of fear lurked round my mind, but even these were fading as it crept through me. I was interested in the sensations, wondering idly how it would take me. At least it wouldn't hurt. I was glad of that. The hurting had worn me out, and it felt so calm now that it was over. Above my waist, the cold slowed its progress. I fancied how it would ease its way up, following veins and arteries, creeping inexorably through me. I thought of it as something living, something which lived through crawling into my body. I knew it didn't work like that, but it felt as if it did, and that seemed a good enough reason to believe it. I wasn't going to argue about it with anyone. Of that I could be sure. I almost laughed out loud at the idea. I felt so tired, sleepy tired, and weak. I'd never felt so weak. A limbless, disembodied feeling. It was odd. I jerked down sharply and bounced on the rope. When I turned to look at the wall, I realized I was going down. Simon was lowering me again. I shook my head, trying to clear the lethargy. He had no chance. I was sure that he was gambling on being able to get me down before the knot jammed. Secretly, I hoped he could, and knew with certainty that he had no chance. I screamed a warning into the night. There was no reply. I continued falling steadily. I looked down and saw the crevasse below me. I could see it clearly. When I looked up, I could no longer make out the top of the cliff. The ropes ran up into snow flurries and disappeared. There was a small jerk, then another, and I stopped. Half an hour passed. I stopped shouting at Simon. I knew he was in the same situation as me, unable to move. Either he would die in his seat, or be pulled from it by the constant strain of my body. I wondered whether I would die before this happened. It would happen as soon as he lost consciousness, and maybe he would do so before me. On the rope I was clear of the worst avalanches. He would be colder than me. Each thought of death, of mine or his, came quite unemotionally. Matter of fact, I was too tired to care. Perhaps if I was scared I would fight harder, I thought, and then dismissed the idea. I was scared tying the loops, and it hadn't helped. Tony Kurtz had fought and fought when he was dying on the Eiger. He had never once stopped fighting, and he had dropped suddenly dead on the rope, still fighting to live. Rescuers had watched him die. It seemed strange to be in the same situation and not be bothered. Maybe it's the cold. Won't be long now. I'll not last till morning. Won't see the sun either. I hope Simon doesn't die, that's hard. He shouldn't have to die for me. I jerked upright, the drifting, aimless thoughts pushed away and replaced with a consuming anger at what had happened. I screamed at the wind, swearing and yelling blind. On the last bloody lower, and after all that pain, you shit! You fucking bastard! Words wasted into the snow and wind, shouted to no one in particular in a shaking fury of bitterness and grievance. Idiot words, as meaningless as the hissing empty wind around me. Anger surged through me. It warmed me, shook me, driving the cold off in a tirade of obscenities and frustrated tears. I cried for myself and swore at myself. Everything came down to me. It was my knee that was smashed. I had fallen, and I was dying, and Simon with me. The rope slipped. I bounced down a few inches. Then again. Had he freed the knot? I slipped again, stopped. Then I knew what was about to happen. He was coming down. I was pulling him off. I hung still and waited for it to happen. Any minute. Any minute.
Joe had smiled as I let him slide away from me. It wasn't much of a smile. His pain twisted it into a grimace. I let him go fast and ignored his cries. He was quickly gone from my torch beam, and as another avalanche swept over my head, the rope disappeared as well. Apart from his weight on my waist, there was no sign of his existence. I kept the speed going. The belay plate was easy to control despite my deadened fingers. They were bad now. I worried about them, as I had done since we left the col. I knew Joe's climbing days were over. But now I was scared for my hands. There was no telling how bad they would be. I had a quick look when it was light, but I couldn't see how deep the damage was. Four fingertips were blackened, and one thumb, but there was no saying whether the others wouldn't also go the same way. I heard a faint cry from below, and the rope jerked slightly. Poor bastard, I thought. I had hurt him all the way down. It was strange being so cold about it. It had been hard not to feel for him. It was easier now. We had made such fast progress, efficient. I felt proud about it. We had held it all together, and that was good. The lowering had been easier than I had expected, especially with Joe digging the seats for me. He had really held it together. That was some control. I'd never asked him to dig the seats, but he just went ahead and did it. Wonder whether I would have done that. Who knows? My hands were stiffening again. They always got bad before the knot, stiff like claws. The rope ran out smoothly. I'd been careful to avoid any tangles. The idea of holding Joe with one hand and trying to unsnarl a tangled and frozen rope didn't bear thinking about. The pull at my harness increased. The slope must be steepening again, I thought. There were another 70 feet to go before the halfway knot had to be changed over. I increased the rate of descent. I knew it was hurting him. When it had been light, I could see his pain for a long way down. But we had got down. It was necessary. Another faint cry came from the darkness. A rushing flow of snow poured over me again. I hunched deeper into the seat, feeling the snow settle and crumble slightly. The seats lasted for the lower, but by then they were well on their way to collapse. Suddenly I jolted heavily forward from the waist and nearly came out of the seat. I threw my weight back and down into the snow, bracing my legs hard against the sudden pressure. Christ! Joe's fallen! I let the rope slide slowly to a stop, trying to avoid the impact I would have got if I had stopped it dead. The pressure remained constant. My harness bit into my hips, and the rope pulling tautly between my legs threatened to rip me down through the floor of the seat. After half an hour, I let the rope slide again. Whatever Joe had gone over had stopped him getting his weight off the rope. My legs had numbed as the pressure on my hips cut the blood supply away. I tried to think of something to do other than lower. There was nothing. Joe had not attempted to climb back up. I had felt no trembling in the rope to tell me he was attempting something. There was no chance of hauling him up. Already the seat was half its original size. It had steadily disintegrated from beneath my thighs. I couldn't hold the weight much longer. The steep sections higher on the face had been less than 50 feet high. I decided that he would be able to get his weight off the rope after a short distance and set a belay up. I had no choice. As the rope ran out, I realized that the pressure wasn't easing. Joe was still hanging free. What in hell's name was I lowering him over? I looked down at the slack rope being fed through the belay plate. 20 feet below, I spotted the knot coming steadily towards me. I began swearing, trying to urge Joe to touch down onto something solid. At 10 feet, I stopped lowering. The pressure on the rope hadn't changed. I kept stamping my feet. I was trying to halt the collapse of the seat, but it wasn't working. I felt the first shivers of fear. Snow hit me again from behind, surging over and around me. My thighs moved down fractionally. The avalanche pushed me forward and filled the seat behind my back. Oh, God, I'm coming off. Then it stopped, as abruptly as it had started. I let the rope slide 5 feet, thinking furiously. Could I hold the rope with one hand below the knot and change the plate over? I lifted one hand from the rope and stared at it. I couldn't squeeze it into a fist. I thought of holding the rope locked against the plate by winding it round my thigh and then releasing the plate from my harness. Stupid idea. I couldn't hold Joe's weight with my hands alone. If I released the plate, 150 feet of free rope would run unstoppable through my hands, and then it would rip me clear off the mountain. It had been nearly an hour since Joe had gone over the drop. I was shaking with cold. My grip on the rope kept easing despite my efforts. The rope slowly edged down and the knot pressed against my right fist. I can't hold it, can't stop it. The thought overwhelmed me. The snow slides and wind and cold were forgotten. I was being pulled off. The seat moved beneath me and snow slipped away past my feet. I slipped a few inches, stamping my feet deep into the slope, halted the movement. God, I had to do something. The knife. The thought came out of nowhere. Of course, the knife. Be quick, come on, get it. The knife was in my sack. It took an age to let go a hand and slip the strap off my shoulder, and then repeat it with the other hand. I braced the rope across my thigh and held onto the plate with my right hand as hard as I could. Fumbling at the catches on the rucksack, I could feel the snow slowly giving way beneath me. Panic threatened to swamp me. I felt in the sack, searching desperately for the knife. My hand closed round something smooth, and I pulled it out. The red plastic handle slipped in my mitt, and I nearly dropped it. I put it in my lap before tugging my mitt off with my teeth. I had already made the decision. There was no other option left to me. The metal blade stuck to my lips when I opened it with my teeth. I reached down to the rope and then stopped. The slack rope. Clear the loose rope twisted round my foot. If it tangled, it would rip me down with it. I carefully cleared it to one side and checked that it all lay in the seat away from the belay plate. I reached down again, and this time I touched the blade to the rope. It needed no pressure. The taut rope exploded at the touch of the blade, and I flew backwards into the seat as the pulling strain vanished. I was shaking. Leaning back against the snow, I listened to a furious hammering in my temple as I tried to calm my breathing. Snow hissed over me in a torrent. I ignored it as it poured over my face and chest, spurting into the open zip at my neck and on down below. It kept coming, washing across me and down after the cut rope and after Joe. I was alive, and for the moment that was all I could think about. Where Joe was or whether he was alive didn't concern me in the long silence after the cutting. His weight had gone from me. There was only the wind and the avalanches left to me. When at last I sat up, the slack rope fell from my hips. One frayed end protruded from the belay plate. He had gone. Had I killed him? I didn't answer the thought, though some urging in the back of my mind told me that I had. I felt numb, freezing cold and shocked into a numb silence. I stared bleakly into the swirling snow beneath me, wondering at what had happened. There was no guilt, not even sorrow. I stared at the faint torch beam cutting through the snow and felt haunted by its emptiness. I was tempted to shout to him, but stifled the cry. It wouldn't be heard. I could be sure of that. I shivered in the wind as the cold crept up my back. Another avalanche swept over me in the darkness, alone on a storm-swept, avalanching mountain face, and becoming dangerously cold. I was left with no choice but to forget about Joe until the morning. I stood up and turned into the slope. The belay seat was full of avalanched powder. I started to dig, and soon I'd excavated a sufficiently large hole to lie